The Mystery of the Blue Train, Agatha Christie. Chapter 17. An Aristocratic Gentleman. "You've been to the Riviera before, George," said Poirot to his valet the following morning. George was an intensely English, rather wooden-faced individual. "Yes, sir. I was here 2 years ago when I was in the service of Lord Edward Frampton." "And today," murmured his master, "you are here with Hercule Poirot. How one mounts in the world." The valet made no reply to this observation. After a suitable pause, he asked, "The brown lounge suit, sir. The wind is somewhat chilly today." "There is a grease spot on the waistcoat," objected Poirot. "A morceau of filet de sole à la Jeannette alighted there when I was lunching at the Ritz last Tuesday." "There's no spot there now, sir," said George reproachfully. "I have removed it."
"Très bien," said Poirot. "I am pleased with you, George."
"Thank you, sir." There was a pause, and then Poirot murmured dreamily, "Supposing, my good George, that you had been born in the same social sphere as your late master, Lord Edward Frampton, that, penniless yourself, you had married an extremely wealthy wife, but that wife proposed to divorce you, with excellent reasons. What would you do about it?"
"I should endeavor, sir," replied George, "to make her change her mind, by peaceful or by forcible methods." George looked shocked.
"You will excuse me, sir," he said, "but a gentleman of the aristocracy would not behave like a Whitechapel coster. I wonder now. He would not do anything low."
"Would he not, George?"
"I wonder now. Well, perhaps you're right." There was a knock on the door. George went to it and opened it a discreet inch or two. A low, murmured colloquy went on, and then the valet returned to Poirot.
"A note, sir."
Poirot took it. It was from Monsieur Caux, the commissary of police. "We are about to interrogate the Comte de la Roche. The juge d'instruction begs that you will be present."
"Quickly, my suit, Georges. I must hasten myself."
A quarter of an hour later, spick and span in his brown suit, Poirot entered the examining magistrate's room. Monsieur Caux was already there, and both he and Monsieur Carrège greeted Poirot with polite empressement.
"The affair is somewhat discouraging," murmured Monsieur Caux.
"It appears the Comte arrived in Nice the day before the murder."
"If that is true, it will settle your affair nicely for you," responded Poirot.
Monsieur Carrège cleared his throat. "We must not accept this alibi without very cautious inquiry," he declared. He struck the bell upon the table with his hand. In another minute, a tall, dark man, exquisitely dressed, with a somewhat haughty cast of countenance, entered the room. So very aristocratic-looking was the Count that it would have seemed sheer heresy even to whisper that his father had been an obscure corn chandler in Nantes, which, as a matter of fact, was the case. Looking at him, one would have been prepared to swear that innumerable ancestors of his must have perished by the guillotine in the French Revolution.
"I am here, gentlemen," said the Count haughtily. "May I ask why you wish to see me?"
"Pray be seated, Monsieur le Comte," said the examining magistrate politely. "It is the affair of the death of Madame Kettering that we are investigating."
"The death of Madame Kettering? I do not understand."
"You were, acquainted with the lady, I believe, Monsieur le Comte?"
"Certainly I was acquainted with her. What has that to do with the matter?"
Sticking an eyeglass in his eye, he looked coldly round the room, his glance resting longest on Poirot, who was gazing at him with a kind of simple, innocent admiration, which was most pleasing to the Count's vanity. Monsieur Carrège leaned back in his chair and cleared his throat.
"You do not perhaps know, Monsieur le Comte," he paused, "that Madame Kettering was murdered."
"Murdered! Mon Dieu, how terrible!" The surprise and the sorrow were excellently done, so well done indeed as to seem wholly natural. "Madame Kettering was strangled between Paris and Lyon," continued Monsieur Carrège, "and her jewels were stolen." "It is iniquitous," cried the Count warmly. "The police should do something about these trained bandits. Nowadays no one is safe." "In Madame's handbag," continued the judge, "we found a letter to her from you. She had, it seemed, arranged to meet you." The Count shrugged his shoulders and spread out his hands. "Of what use are concealments?" he said frankly. "We are all men of the world. Privately and between ourselves, I admit the affair." "You met her in Paris and traveled down with her, I believe," said Monsieur Carrège. "That was the original arrangement, but by Madame's wish it was changed. I was to meet her at Hyères." "You did not meet her on the train at Gare de Lyon on the evening of the 14th? "On the contrary, I arrived in Nice on the morning of that day, so what you suggest is impossible." Quite so," said Monsieur Carrège. "As a matter of form, you would perhaps give me an account of your movements during the evening and night of the 14th. The Count reflected for a minute. "I dined in Monte Carlo at the Café de Paris. Afterwards, I went to Le Sporting. I won a few thousand francs," he shrugged his shoulders. "I returned home at perhaps 1 o'clock. "Pardon me, monsieur, but how did you return home?" "In my own two-seater car." "No one was with you?" "No one." "You could produce witnesses in support of this statement?" "Doubtless many of my friends saw me there that evening. I dined alone." "Your servant admitted you on your return to your villa?" "I let myself in with my own latchkey." "Ah," murmured the magistrate. Again he struck the bell on the table with his hand. The door opened, and a messenger appeared. "Bring in the maid Mason," said Monsieur Carrège. "Very good, Monsieur le Juge." Ada Mason was brought in. "Will you be so good, mademoiselle, as to look at this gentleman? To the best of your ability, was it he who entered your mistress's compartment in Paris?" The woman looked long and searchingly at the Count, who was, Poirot fancied, rather uneasy under this scrutiny. "I could not say, sir, I am sure," said Mason at last. "It might be, and again it might not. Seeing as how I only saw his back, it's hard to say. I rather think it was the gentleman. But you're not sure." "No," said Mason unwillingly. "No, I am not sure." "You have seen this gentleman before in Curzon Street?" Mason shook her head. "I should not be likely to see any visitors that come to Curzon Street," she explained, "unless they were staying in the house." "Very well, that will do," said the examining magistrate sharply. Evidently he was disappointed. "One moment," said Poirot. "There is a question I would like to put to mademoiselle, if I may." "Certainly, Monsieur Poirot, certainly, by all means." Poirot addressed himself to the maid. "What happened to the tickets?"
"The tickets, sir?"
"Yes, the tickets from London to Nice. Did you or your mistress have them?"
"The mistress had her own Pullman ticket, sir. The others were in my charge."
"What happened to them?"
"I gave them to the conductor on the French train, sir. He said it was usual. I hope I did it right, sir."
"Oh, quite right, quite right. A mere matter of detail." Both Monsieur Coe and the examining magistrate looked at him curiously. Mason stood uncertainly for a minute or two, and then the magistrate gave her a brief nod of dismissal, and she went out. Poirot scribbled something on a scrap of paper and handed it across to Monsieur Carrège. The latter read it, and his brow cleared. "Well, gentlemen," demanded the Count hotly, "am I to be detained further?"
"Assuredly not. Assuredly not," Monsieur Carrège hastened to say, with a great deal of amiability. "Everything is now cleared up as regards your own position in this affair. Naturally, in view of Madame's letter, we were bound to question you.
The Count rose, picked up his handsome stick from the corner, and with a rather curt bow, left the room.
"And that is that," said Monsieur Carrège. "You were quite right, Monsieur Poirot. Much better to let him feel he's not suspected. Two of my men will shadow him night and day, and at the same time will go into the question of the alibi. It seems to me rather a fluid one."
"Possibly," agreed Poirot thoughtfully. "I asked Monsieur Kettering to come here this morning," continued the magistrate, "though really I doubt if we have much to ask him. But there are one or two suspicious circumstances." He paused, rubbing his nose.
"Such as?" asked Poirot.
"Well," the magistrate coughed, "this lady with whom he's said to be traveling, Mademoiselle Morel, she's staying at one hotel and he at another. That strikes me as rather odd."
"It looks," said Monsieur Caux, "as though they were being careful."
"Exactly," said Monsieur Carrège triumphantly. "And what should they have to be careful about?"
"An excess of caution is suspicious, eh?" said Poirot.
"Précisément."
"We might, I think," murmured Poirot, "ask Monsieur Kettering one or two questions." The magistrate gave instructions. A moment or two later, Derek Kettering, debonair as ever, entered the room.
"Good morning, monsieur," said the judge politely.
"Good morning," said Derek Kettering curtly. "You sent for me. Has anything fresh turned up?"
"Pray sit down, monsieur."
Derek took a seat and flung his hat and stick on the table.
"Well," he asked impatiently,
"we have so far no fresh data," said Monsieur Carrège cautiously.
"That's very interesting," said Derek dryly. "Did you send for me here in order to tell me that?"
"We naturally thought, monsieur, that you would like to be informed of the progress of the case," said the magistrate severely.
"Even if the progress is non-existent?"
"We also wish to ask you a few questions."
"Ask away."
"You're quite sure that you neither saw nor spoke with your wife on the train?"
"I've answered that already. I did not."
"You had no doubt your reasons?"
Derek stared at him suspiciously.
"I did not know she was on the train," he explained, spacing his words elaborately, as though to someone dull of intellect.
"That is what you say, yes," murmured Monsieur Carrège.
A quick frown suffused Derek's face.
"I should like to know what you're driving at. Do you know what I think, Monsieur Carrège?"
"What do you think, monsieur?"
"I think the French police are vastly overrated. Surely you must have some data as to these gangs of train robbers. It's outrageous that such a thing should happen on a train de luxe like that, and that the French police should be helpless to deal with the matter."
"We're dealing with it, monsieur, never fear."
"Madame Kettering, I understand, did not leave a will," interposed Poirot suddenly. His fingertips were joined together, and he was looking intently at the ceiling.
"I don't think she ever made one," said Kettering.
"Why?"
"It's a very pretty little fortune that you inherit here," said Poirot.
"A very pretty little fortune."
Although his eyes were still on the ceiling, he managed to see the dark flush that rose to Derek Kettering's face.
"What do you mean? And who are you?"
Poirot gently uncrossed his knees, withdrew his gaze from the ceiling, and looked the young man full in the face.
"My name is Hercule Poirot," he said quietly, "and I am probably the greatest detective in the world. You are quite sure that you did not see or speak to your wife on that train? What are you getting at? Do you mean to insinuate that I killed her?"
He laughed suddenly. "I mustn't lose my temper. It's too palpably absurd. Why, if I killed her, I should have had no need to steal her jewels, would I?"
"That is true," murmured Poirot, with a rather crestfallen air. "I didn't think of that."
"If ever there were a clear case of murder and robbery, this is it," said Derek Kettering.
"Poor Ruth! It was those damned rubies did for her. It must have got about she had them with her. There has been murder done for those same stones before now, I believe."
Poirot sat up suddenly in his chair. A very faint green light glowed in his eyes. He looked extraordinarily like a sleek, well-fed cat. "One more question, Monsieur Kettering," he said. "Will you give me the date when you last saw your wife?" "Let me see," Kettering reflected. "It must have been, yes, over 3 weeks ago. I'm afraid I can't give you the date exactly." "No matter," said Poirot dryly. "That's all I wanted to know." "Well," said Derek Kettering impatiently, "anything further?" He looked towards Monsieur Carrège. The latter sought inspiration from Poirot and received it in a very faint shake of the head. "No, Monsieur Kettering," he said politely. "No, I do not think we need trouble you any further. I wish you good morning." "Good morning," said Kettering. He went out, banging the door behind him. Poirot leaned forward and spoke sharply as soon as the young man was out of the room. "Tell me," he said peremptorily, "when did you speak of these rubies to Monsieur Kettering?" "I have not spoken of them," said Monsieur Carrège. "It was only yesterday afternoon that we learnt about them from Monsieur Fanaldin." "Yes, but there was a mention of them in the Comte's letter." Monsieur Carrège looked pained. "Naturally, I did not speak of that letter to Monsieur Kettering," he said in a shocked voice. "It would have been most indiscreet at the present juncture of affairs." Poirot leaned forward and tapped the table. "Then how did he know about them?" he demanded softly. "Madame could not have told him, for he has not seen her for 3 weeks. It seems unlikely that either Monsieur Fanaldin or his secretary would have mentioned them. Their interviews with him have been on entirely different lines, and there's not been any hint or reference to them in the newspapers." He got up and took his hat and stick. "And yet," he murmured to himself, "our gentleman knows all about them. I wonder now. Yes, I wonder." Chapter 18. Derek Lunches. Derek Kettering went straight to the Negresco, where he ordered a couple of cocktails and disposed of them rapidly. Then he stared moodily out over the dazzling blue sea. He noted the passers-by mechanically. A damn dull crowd, badly dressed and painfully uninteresting. One hardly ever saw anything worthwhile nowadays. Then he corrected this last impression rapidly, as a woman placed herself at a table a little distance away from him. She was wearing a marvelous confection of orange and black, with a little hat that shaded her face. He ordered a third cocktail. Again he stared out to sea, and then suddenly he started. A well-known perfume assailed his nostrils, and he looked up to see the orange and black lady standing beside him. He saw her face now, and recognized her. It was Morel. She was smiling that insolent, seductive smile he knew so well. "Derek," she murmured, "you are pleased to see me, no?" She dropped into a seat the other side of the table. "But welcome me, then, stupid one," she mocked. "This is an unexpected pleasure," said Derek. "When did you leave London?" She shrugged her shoulders. "A day or two ago." "And the Parthenon?" "I have, how do you say it, given them the chuck." "Really? You're not very amiable, Derek." "Do you expect me to be?" Morel lit a cigarette and puffed at it for a few minutes before saying, "You think, perhaps, that it's not prudent so soon?" Derek stared at her. Then he shrugged his shoulders and remarked formally, "You are lunching here?" "Eh bien oui, I'm lunching with you." "I'm exceedingly sorry," said Derek. "I have a very important engagement." "Mon Dieu! But you men are like children," exclaimed the dancer. "But yes, it is the spoilt child that you act to me. Ever since that day in London when you flung yourself out of my flat, you sulk. Ah, mais c'est ennui." "My dear girl," said Derek, "I really don't know what you're talking about. We agreed in London that rats desert a sinking ship. That is all that there is to be said." In spite of his careless words, his face looked haggard and strained. Morel leaned forward suddenly. "You cannot deceive me," she murmured. "I know what you have done for me."
He looked up at her sharply. Some undercurrent in her voice arrested his attention. She nodded her head at him. Ah, have no fear. I am discreet. You are magnificent. You have a superb courage. But all the same, it was I who gave you the idea that day when I said to you in London that accidents sometimes happened. And you are not in danger? The police do not suspect you? What the devil? Hush! She held up a slim olive hand with one big emerald on the little finger. You are right. I should not have spoken so in a public place. We will not speak of the matter again, but our troubles are ended. Our life together will be wonderful, wonderful. Derek laughed suddenly, a harsh, disagreeable laugh. So the rats come back, do they? 2 million makes a difference? Of course it does. I ought to have known that, he laughed again. You will help me to spend that 2 million, won't you, Morel? You know how. No woman better. He laughed again. Hush, cried the dancer. What is the matter with you, Derek? See, people are turning to stare at you. Me? I'll tell you what's the matter. I've finished with you, Morel. Do you hear? Finished. Morel did not take it as he expected her to do. She looked at him for a minute or two, and then she smiled softly. But what a child! You are angry, you are sore, and all because I am practical. Did I not always tell you that I adored you? She leaned forward. But I know you, Derek. Look at me. See, it is Morel who speaks to you. You cannot live without her, you know it. I loved you before. I will love you 100 times more now. I will make life wonderful for you, but wonderful. There's no one like Morel. Her eyes burned into his. She saw him grow pale and draw in his breath, and she smiled to herself contentedly. She knew her own magic and power over men. That is settled, she said softly and gave a little laugh. And now, Derek, will you give me lunch? No. He drew in his breath sharply and rose to his feet. I'm sorry, but I told you. I've got an engagement. You're lunching with someone else? Bah, I don't believe it. I'm lunching with that lady over there. He crossed abruptly to where a lady in white had just come up the steps. He addressed her a little breathlessly. Miss Gray, will you have lunch with me? You met me at Lady Tamplin's, if I remember. Catherine looked at him for a minute or two with those thoughtful gray eyes that said so much. Thank you, she said after a moment's pause. I should like to very much.